Another feature of this culture was the manufacture of microliths, and these were blades produced as small as a half an inch long and an eighth of an inch wide. Some of them in there, I think. How much more have we got? Oh, we've got miles of it yet. Well, it won't take long. Well, these microliths, it was the beginning of a tool tradition which came to dominate in some of the cultures of the Mesolithic period. The Magdalenian period is divided into six parts, all with specific features, and the highest point of Magdalenian art in both painting and engraving of cave walls and the carving of antler horn is reached in stage four, to which period the famous painted caves of Altamira or Altamara and Font de Gourmet belong. You'll know about those because they've been publicised for ages. That's all I'm going to say about that culture. The Upper Paleolithic in Britain. Upper Paleolithic culture is only sparsely represented in Great Britain. The most outstanding example is that of a Gravittian-type industry known as the Creswellian, and this is derived from the caves of Creswell Crags in Derbyshire. The Mesolithic of Europe, the Magdalenian culture, the closest adaptation of hunting economy to sub-Arctic climatic conditions, is no longer found in Europe after the beginning of the milder post-glacial period. Another culture, the Hamburgian of northwest Germany, in spite of its distinctive tools, burin, tanged arrowheads and thong cutters of antler, and its lack of harpoons, appears to afford a last glimpse of the hares of the Magdalenian tradition as they moved in the tracks of the northward migrating reindeer. And you will remember that when the ice retreated, the reindeer went north, and so did some of the human beings of that time. They all retreated north. And the cultures termed Mesolithic, which occupy the period between the withdrawal of the ice and the first appearance of agriculture and stock-raising communities, have a different stamp, and in Europe at least, they mark a break with the past. Two factors determine the complex picture they present. As forest grew over Europe again, remember that under the ice, of course, the forests were all destroyed. When the ice receded, the forests again grew. The descendants of the indigenous Paleolithic population at the time were either obliged to adapt themselves to a new environment or to follow the reindeer. Some of them did and some of them didn't. Those that stayed, they had to adapt themselves to a new environment. The great gregarious animals which were hunted by their ancestors had departed or become extinct, and the methods of the hunt had to be modified. Instead, of course, you had the pursuit of forest game, ox, red deer, elk, wild pig, etc., beaver and so on. The other factor was the arrival in Europe, as the climate improved, of people bearing a culture involved in North Africa. Remember that Mesolithic people were still food gatherers, and some communities were confined to the sea coast on the edge of the forest, and there fished and collected shellfish. Others depended more on hunting and adapted themselves to a forest life. Others again, the hares of a North African industrial tradition, sought out the forest-free areas of the interior. To a varying degree in each case, their material equipment is developed from elements already present in the Upper Paleolithic. The principal tools are of flint, and whilst antler and bone tools are also made, the stimulus and ability to carve these materials artistically have, like the pictorial art of the Upper Paleolithic, which I've mentioned, They quite vanish in that period. All Mesolithic cultures include scrapers of various shapes, frequently burines, and always many untrimmed but utilized flakes. The most striking characteristic of the majority of the cultures in the inclusion is the inclusion of a varying types of tiny implements called microliths. And these are of irregular geometric shapes according to the tradition. And I think you'll find in those plates there are a few examples. And some of these were designed for mounting as cutting tools. And singly they form the barks, the barbs or points of bone arrows and no doubt fish hooks. And they were mounted in series. They combined to form a cutting edge. In Britain, there were four divisions of Mesolithic culture, which I'm not going to go into. The higher levels of Creswell Crag, Derbyshire. The Maglemose culture, originally native to Denmark. The Starkar example in Yorkshire, about 7000 BC. And the Sorveterian, after a site in France. And the Tardenosian, which was brought from the people from Africa. There's not much more. We're now, of course, we've progressed all this way in a matter of about an hour and a quarter. We've traversed a period of about 5 million years. I think that's a very, very good effort on my part. We are now in to the Neolithic, which we've already dealt with. And by about 1500 BC, many items of Neolithic equipment echo, as it were, the higher metal-using culture. And this was the culture of the Mediterranean area. As far as the Mesolithic people were concerned, there was great difficulty in obtaining supplies of metal, principally copper and tin, from places like Ireland, for example, and consequently they tried to copy metal tools in stone. And you've got to remember that the shapes of the earliest metal tools were based upon stone types. But they had developed, being metal, it had developed certain particular shapes to metal, and these were now used and transferred to stone. In other words, you had a sort of a cross-cultural phenomenon where metal tools were the copies of stone tools, and the introduction of certain facets which were new and particular to metal. And when metal couldn't be obtained, they tried to produce stone tools as the metal tools were being produced in the Mediterranean area. Now, there was the exploitation of igneous rocks for axes, and there were apparently regular factory sites on the mountainside at a place in Ireland, at Great Langdale, Cumberland, and Cornish greenstone, which is a kind of igneous rock, was distributed over southwest England. Flint was mined, and the mines, the principal ones, were the Graves mines at Norfolk, and this was dated to about 2400 and 1600 BC. The Chisbury, Sussex mines around 3000 BC, and these dates were arrived at by radiocarbon dating. You had the example, of course, of the Windmill Hill Neolithic in Wiltshire, which you have already dealt with in an earlier talk. The first metal users in England belonged to the Beaker culture, which reached Britain from the coast of Brittany. Now, there's been a lot of stuff written about these Beaker people. V. Gordon Child has written extensively on them. But they apparently came from the region of the Lower Rhine about 1900 BC, and they were users of metals. As you know, metal was introduced into Britain about 1800 BC and slightly earlier in the other part of Europe. But how far these people introduced their own metallurgical industry or imported their bronze from Ireland, and I've mentioned that earlier on, where the manufacture of bronze implements began at about the same time, and this remains uncertain. The Beaker people, characterized by the production of a beaker-like vessel, which is very often found in their graves and burial places. The Beaker people buried their dead in trench graves or in boxes constructed of stone slabs, often under round burrows. You've all heard about the round burrows and the long burrows that are found all over the east of England and the south. And they are further distinguished by their pottery and by flint and bronze daggers, which were sometimes placed in their graves. And the Bronze Age of the Middle East, as I said earlier, developed about 3000 BC. In Europe, about 1900 BC. And the Iron Age started about 300 BC. And that, you will be relieved to know, is all I've got to say at the present time about Tall Man the Toolmaker.
Well, I'd like to thank Tom Rickles for a very informative talk. I wonder if anyone has any specific questions or anything to say.
Extremely difficult to know these terms.
I agree. Quite right. I agree wholeheartedly. You see, the fact is that this is listed as an introduction to prehistory. Now, I might add that it's a very, very sketchy and incomplete introduction, because there's so much that you can't possibly put in. I mean, I've put a lot of stuff in which probably, for the most part, has gone over people's heads. But it's necessary in order to get some kind of a sequence and to understand what we're talking about. Now, the use that I can see of these talks, and that includes also the talks on history and political economy as well, is that people will start to take up the study themselves. Now, I don't know whether anybody has learnt very much from what I've said on the subject, but this I can be quite certain of. I know more about anthropology since I've been doing these lectures than I ever did before. So that it would be perhaps a good idea if we got more lecturers in different subjects, and they could learn that way rather than imparting the knowledge to other people. But I agree. I mean, it's very difficult where history is concerned as well, although you're more familiar with the terms. But when people are dealing with various dates and periods and tendencies, you've got to come to grips with it yourself.
Yes, I think that these talks have been informative, though, and I'm sure, you know, everyone's picked something up. So.
Yeah.
What I want to say, there's a covering of South America. There's those people, Inca, Aztec, Toltecs and Mayas.
Yes.
Now, out of those, they knew how to harden copper.
Right.
Even copper is not hardened. It's a very tough metal. Prove it. Look at your friend that gas goes along. Before they start to use steel in modern times in steam pipes, they used to use copper, and that's taken a lot of wear and tear. Now, I've got something else here to do. Mexico City is ringed by mountain. It was built on the ruins of the Aztec city of Tenochtitlan. That's all I've got to say.
Well, in relation to that, what you have to remember, of course, is that all of those peoples that you've mentioned, are all in stages of civilization, that comparatively speaking, they're in modern times. You see, the Aztecs and the Incas and the Toltecs were all organized property-based civilizations. It's quite true that they were more liberal in some senses. You know, I'm talking about liberal with a capital L, than a lot of the more modern kinds of civilization or examples of civilization. And in other aspects, they weren't. For example, the Aztecs had a very awkward custom of tearing the hearts out of thousands of sacrificed victims for religious purposes. But as far as their administration was concerned, the Incas of Peru, for example, they had an organization which was far superior to anything that the Spaniards did. And in fact, when the Spaniards conquered Peru, the whole economic and cultural aspect of Peru degenerated and has never since recovered. There are comparatively no roads at the present time, even in modern times, in Peru. And yet, during the period of the Incas, there was close integration and communication, and there were roads which were kept up by the government. And there was a very, very well-run organization. And generally speaking, most of the population at least were guaranteed some kind of a reasonable existence, although technically speaking, they were all subjects of the Inca. So that what you're really talking about is a period of civilization which has not very much to do with the period that we are talking about. You see, the fact is that the Paleolithic period, you could say, stretches back as far as 4 to 5 million years in the Pliocene. See, that would go into the upper Pliocene. That's the period before the Pleistocene. The Pleistocene's only a period of some 2 million odd years, or nearly 3 million years. So that mankind has been making tools and practicing a kind of cooperation, primitive though it was, entirely different to modern civilization, and they carried this on for not thousands of years, but for millions of years. And really, the Paleolithic is one of the most important periods, if not the most important period, of human existence, because quite a number of essential discoveries were effected in that period. The use of fire, the ability to make stone, to make tools, to develop art, the wheel, for example. Well, the wheel was invented later in the Upper Paleolithic and the Neolithic, but nevertheless, in Stone Age culture, you had the production of a lot of the essential characteristics that modern civilization depends upon.
Further questions?
What are the dates, roughly speaking, at which the ownership of these tools developed from?
Well, that is very, very hard to ascertain. I mean, most of these conclusions are intelligent assumptions, and as you can gather from what I've just said, that the understanding of all these processes is very, very complicated. It's not an easy matter to unravel what took place for millions of years from a few bones and a few stone tools. And the only conclusion that can be come to is the assumptions based upon various facts which determine a certain kind of attitude. You see, it would have been impossible for Paleolithic man, particularly in the early days, to operate anything but a small family-based cooperation. And the organization of Paleolithic man was based upon a family organization, as is, of course, modern Paleolithic man, like the Kalahari peoples and the peoples in the Siberia forest. Their relationships are very similar. As a matter of fact, a lot of the conclusions are drawn from the existing Stone Age peoples to assess what happened and to assume what happened in the early Paleolithic times. And a lot of the discoverers have substantiated this. I mean, there's no indication, nor could there have been, of organized warfare. Mankind was so taken up with conquering the environment, and there was such a lot of space to do it, that he couldn't spend his time making war. Obviously, it wasn't possible. And there is plenty of indication to suggest that groups of people got together and hunted large game on a cooperative basis. There have been instances, for example, in Spain, there's one instance where a lot of elephant skeletons were discovered in a swamp, and it was concluded that the group of people, whether you call it a tribe — I don't like calling it a tribe, because tribal culture is a different proposition altogether from food gathering and hunter bands — but obviously there was a group cooperation in which these animals were driven into the mud, and then they were slaughtered with stone-tipped arrows. So there's no period. I mean, you're dealing with 5 million years, and all you can say is that around about 10,000 years ago, you got the development of food production. It was with food production and the bringing into being of the production of surpluses that brought on the aspects of private property. And I gave, you know, the reasons why, for example, women became more degraded as a group than men did, because obviously for biological reasons, man was the hunter, and he became the owner of the animals when they were domesticated, and the forms of property which evolved were already more or less in the hands of men.
So would it be fair to say that most of these tools that we've been describing were, on the whole, used communally by the people?
All of what?
All of the tools we've been describing.
Oh.
Would, on the whole, have been used communally by the groups of people that...
Oh, yes, there were... I mean, there has been suggestions that trading took place. Well, trading would not have taken place until the Upper Paleolithic at the very utmost, and it would have been on a basis of simple barter. I mean, it would be a question of... there were these sites which have been called flint tool factories, where tools were produced and apparently distributed all over the place. Now, what they got in return, obviously, were things that other people had produced. Food, for example. You couldn't spend most of the time making flint axes all day without having some food. So, the food must have been supplied by other members of the community. So it was a cooperative position that they were in. And of course, there was no need for anything else, because there was no property. There was no warfare about property. It's only when war becomes profitable that you get it developing. And it developed on the basis of a community. You know, when you had communities producing harvests and other communities whose harvest has failed, the tendency would be to make war on the other and pinch what they've got. Well, of course, this is a characteristic of the Neolithic. I mean, the most warlike people, as a matter of fact, have not been hunters and food gatherers, they've been farmers. Farmers have been the most warlike people of the lot.
Any final points?
Well, what amazes me about this type of man, especially when it comes to dealing with metals, is how he does it. You can see pretty well how he can deal with stone in its cold age. It's direct, it's simple, it's natural. It's got nothing to do but chip it with other stones and mould it to what he wants it's useful.
Yeah.
Using the fire, of course, to vary, you know, I suppose have a variety of food, boil it to it. When it comes to incorporating it in the use of providing implements, metal implements, it requires a tremendous amount of heat. I take it the only thing they had available then for burning was trees, wood. That doesn't give a high power to heat, does it? And it doesn't, certainly doesn't give up unless you use terrific quantities. You don't get the sustained heat that you get from other fuels, like coal.
Well, you've...
When you get up to the Romans and find the difficulty they had, I mean, it's often said that the Romans, if they could have found a fuel that gave the centigrade of heat that coal and oil give, then they were off on the road to capitalism. In other words, you don't go from slavery to feudalism. But they didn't find us. But all the same, as I see, they were specialising in coppers and bronzes and metals. And how the hell they did it, how the hell they melted and smelted and moulded these implements, these weapons.
First of all, the first metals to be used were bronze. And it's assumed that... Well, bronze is very soft. Tin and copper are relatively soft metals. And it's been assumed that it was an accidental occurrence, or a number of accidental occurrences, where you had fires being lighted for purposes of cooking or something like that, and bronze-bearing ores and tin ores were in the stones that were used as firestones. And, of course, it would be a fairly gradual process to begin with. Now, when you talk about the degree of heat, it's not true to say that they didn't have methods. They had methods of blast furnaces on a very, very small scale, but they cottoned onto the idea of using... using a kind of a blast furnace idea of draft to get extra heat. And obviously, bronze was something that could be worked with a much less degree of heat than iron. You see, and I mean, bronze lasted for quite a long time.
Yeah.
The Iron Age only started... about 300 BC, and that on a very, very restricted line.
You see the way they didn't. Old pottery was sort of non-glazed up mortal about 2 centuries ago. It wasn't until they could, they found coal, more or less, that they could start sort of glazing and enamelling. That demanded tremendous heat to melt those things.
Well, it demanded a lot of heat to make the pottery anyway, to bake it.
I thought the Iron Age came to Britain with the... Celtic migrations, and
they
supplanted the Bronze Age civilization, the
Iberians,
as well
as the other BC. Well, you see, you'll find that a lot of these people were still using bronze. A lot of this, as a matter of fact, a lot of the Celtic artifacts that are discovered are bronze, and so are the weapons.
See, the Hopi Indians have
they didn't use metal.
No,
gold. No, they never knew. Oh, well, you're talking about gold.
Yes,
I'm talking. Plastic. I thought you were talking about metals for implements and weapons.
Even in the Incas and the Aztecs, who made these ornaments of gold.
Yeah.
Gold's got a terrific high melting point.
Didn't the Greeks have metal in before Pericles?
Well, the Greeks had bronze, didn't they? You see, bronze came to the Mediterranean area about 3000 BC. And I mean, the Greeks were at the height of their civilization around about 600 BC. I mean, Aristotle and all these people were going around in about 600 BC. It's a comparatively modern phenomena, the Greek civilization. It's not all that ancient.
No,
I mean, one of the most ancient civilizations is the Egyptian.
600 BC is their height. It's 300 years earlier than 300 BC.
Yeah, well, all those warring elements in the Mesopotamian area were using bronze. The Egyptians used bronze for a long, long, long time.
Oh, did I have using bronze? But I thought the Iron Age.
No, not sure. So.
Right. Well, thank Comrade Waters again. And I remember that in 3 weeks' time, which is, I think, the 14th of June, there will be the final meeting.